Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Michigan Avenue Media and the World of Ink Network. This podcast was founded in 2011 by Marsha Casper Cook and Virginia Grenier. Their focus has always been on helping writers reach their dreams by having informative and entertaining shows. You will also hear the latest information on what's new and exciting in the publishing and marketing industry. And the shows will also cover discussions on screenwriting, audiobooks, and movies. New to the shows will be the latest style and trends in fashion, as well as nutrition, and how Pinterest can add just the right spark of attention you may need for your project. So, sit back and relax and enjoy the show. You can find out more information about our shows and being a guest at www.michiganavenuemedia.com. Hi, everybody. It's Marsha Casper Cook, and Elizabeth and I are doing a show today. And those of you that missed the show yesterday, if you did, it's on demand. It was really good. It was on screenwriting and all sorts of media. And it was Michelle Meek was on it, who is a professor and teaches screenwriting and talks about females in the script writing and screen business. It was a very interesting show. And that's on demand, so you can hear it at any time. And so I will let Elizabeth give the intro today. And this is going to be a great show, so go ahead. Hi, Elizabeth. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing very well. Yeah, we went to the beach this morning, so that was nice. Well, I'm Elizabeth Black, and I write erotica, romance, horror, and dark fiction. And I'm your co-host. So today's guest is Katherine Anderson. She is an award-winning author of two historic mysteries, Hospital Hill and Shadows in the Ward. She was born in 1980 in Western Massachusetts and is a special education teacher. For many years, Kate has worked to painstakingly research and document the insane asylums and state schools in New England, publishing nonfiction books and lecturing on the history of mental illness. So that is our guest for today.
Yeah, and she's very interesting, and this will be a very interesting show, and she's got several books out, and she'll talk about that also. So welcome to the show, Katherine. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're very glad to have you. And,
oh, yeah, we are.
It's a very interesting subject. So, Elizabeth, I know Elizabeth has a lot of questions. So
oh, yeah.
I have a lot
questions.
Of thoughts, but Elizabeth has a lot of questions. Okay, go ahead, Elizabeth.
I want to know, how did you get interested in cemeteries and mental hospitals to begin with? Where did this come from?
Well, I've loved abandoned buildings since I was a kid. I started exploring back before urban exploration was a thing, long before the invention of the internet. Then later in my teaching career, I started out at a residential treatment facility for kids with mental illness. And around the time that I started at that facility, they were getting ready to tear down Northampton State Hospital, which is about 25 minutes north of where I am. And a friend of mine asked if I wanted to go and check it out. So we went up to drive around it. The place was absolutely massive. And a couple of 16-year-old kids came up to us and, you know, the whole, oh, are you guys going in? And we said, no, we were just there to look around. And one of the kids said, oh, that's too bad. We know where the tunnels are. And that was it. I followed these kids. They could have been axe murderers for all I knew. And I followed them right into the tunnels. Just went right in the tunnels. I didn't even think twice about it. I left my friend standing outside, and he's going, wait, you know, I should probably go with you. But that was the first time I'd ever seen an insane asylum up close, and it was absolutely incredible. So, of course, because I'm a history addict, I went home and did as much research as I possibly could and just found out that it was one of so many across the United States, all built on the same architectural plan, all with the same general purpose. And shortly after that, I discovered state schools, which is a whole other animal unto itself.
Yeah,
but
I
just started exploring. I couldn't get enough. I traveled as much as I possibly could, photographed as many as I could, and then started writing about them because I couldn't just get all of that information and not do something with it. So I started writing. And here I am now.
Yeah, there you are. Several, well, you have a lot of books later, you know, and I did ask you the question before that you do go out and speak, and because you have a good subject matter that puts you good, you know, a good place in the market because they want to know what you did. And it sounds so interesting for all of us that are thinking about all this. We just think about it, we not do it.
Right.
I was mentioning to Elizabeth before that Willow Cross used to do shows with us, and she was a ghost. They went on the ghost investigations, and she did go into a lot of these places that have been, you know, that are empty, and it was really scary and freaky. But it was, and they left them the same way. You know, they looked how they looked 40 years ago, 50 years ago. You know, when you went in, how do they look to you? I mean, does it still look the same? Scary?
Well, it depended on the place. It depended on the place. Some of them, you walked in and it was a time capsule. It was almost as if people just, you know, they locked the doors and they walked away. And in many cases, that's exactly what happened. A lot of these places got abandoned little by little as parts of the building became unusable. People migrated, you know, forward in the building. It happened at Northampton. It happened at Danvers. They would just clear the building out slowly and push the patients to different parts of the building. So in many cases, there were parts of these hospitals that had actually been abandoned since the 50s and 60s, and they just kept pushing forward out, you know, until eventually the place was closed. So some of them are, like Westboro State Hospital, for example. Some of the wards date back to the 1860s. So you're standing in the middle of something that was built, you know, 100 plus years ago. And sometimes it looks it. I mean, you're walking around collapses in the floor. There's the roof is missing. You know, you turn a corner and you're literally outside because the floor ends. And it's it can be a little bit scary.
Yeah, I know because I did them with her. Right? I did them with her. We were on the air, and she was in the room with the investigators, and she would come outside, and I go, I can't tell what's going on there because I'm on the radio, remember? On the radio. I said, you have to keep talking to me because I don't know what's going on. You know, and it was weird because they have, you know, the detectors and everything, and then they have stories about it. I think a lot of cities have that where they kept buildings like that going. You know, where people go in and actually, it's a tourist, you know, not the ones I think they have
that. I've always wanted to go inside one of those buildings, but I was always afraid I'd end up inhaling asbestos or getting exposed to lead or something like that. And there weren't any around me. I'm not originally from Massachusetts. I'm originally from Maryland. But when I came up here, I heard about Danvers and later Belchertown. And I'd like to ask you, could you tell us a little bit about that? Because you've written about it. Belchertown State School for the Mentally Retarded. I'd like to know more about that building.
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, honestly, I could tell you the entire place's history from day one. And that is actually my super special announcement. You guys get to find out first before everybody else does. But I've been researching and writing about Belchertown for a very long time. It was my graduate thesis that I just turned in last month and got my MFA. But next
Yay!
July,
congratulations.
Thank
Good,
you.
It's great.
Yeah, it was so exciting, so much fun to do. But next July, my third Images of America book will be coming out, and it is about Belchertown State School. And I'm very excited about it because we're working to build a memorial. We're working to save one of the buildings. It's kind of like a really nice time for this book to be coming out. And there's going to be some images in it that no one has ever seen before, ever. Because they've been in a basement for years on end. So I am very excited. No one knows this yet. You guys are the first ones to find out.
This is great because it's such an interesting, interesting subject. Yeah. It's so interesting, you know, because, you know, I think people are interested in, like Elizabeth said, you know, people would be afraid to do this, you know, because it's not, you know, you're not going to be doing, you know, but I do think, though, as a writer, I miss some of the times, like at the beginning when I wrote, I used to do a little more research than I do now because I've written, obviously, a couple romantic comedies, but, you know, but when I did dramas for my screenplays, it was always so interesting to you know, research things. And I think, you know, always like when people come on and they're talking about that, because it's so interesting, and then that makes you an expert on something that is such a great topic. But you can't really write it well if you don't really do it. You know, you have to do it. You just can't go, oh, it's like this, because, and you know what it's like.
Yeah, and the research sometimes is the best part, but I think for me, especially with Belchertown, I discovered Belchertown in 2002, so 17 years ago now. And when I first went, the whole place was locked down. We couldn't get in. It was getting late at night. It was getting dark. It was the first snow of the year, and the whole campus was completely silent. And I'd never experienced anything like it before in my life. It was completely silent. We came back a couple weeks later, and someone had gone through. We don't know if it was a teenager, an explorer, or someone scrapping the buildings for copper and metal, but someone had popped all the locks, all the construction locks on all the buildings, and all of a sudden, these buildings were just wide open. And
I know. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, people they shouldn't really do that, because you have to really be careful. Because, you know, you could think you're going to be, the stairs are going to be okay, and they're not, or something like that.
You could fall through the floor, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I have been lucky. I have only had a couple of injuries, and they were fairly minor, aside from I did break my ankle falling out of a window at Westboro State Hospital.
Well,
but,
see, that's it. See, that's it. Right.
But that was my own fault. That wasn't the building's fault. That was my fault, because I'm the clumsiest human being ever.
Sometimes when you're trying not to fall or trip or do something, that's when you do, because in your mind you're thinking, I'm going to do this, you know, and then, you know, and it is scary. So when you walked in, do you feel things when you're there also? I mean, do you feel the presence of anything when you're there?
I didn't the first few times that I went, because I didn't have enough knowledge about what I was walking into. So my first couple times at Belchertown, I knew nothing about it. All I knew was that it was a state school, and I mean, it was loaded with abandoned buildings. I mean, this campus was absolutely huge. It encompasses close to 900 acres worth of land.
When did the place open?
It opened technically in 1915, but the farm colony opened before the actual physical school. So there was a farm operating from 1915 to 1922, and then the school itself opened in 1922. So there's a main campus, and then down below it, there's a farm campus. So it's 900 acres in total. But after I started researching and reading about the history of the state school, it changed my experiences going there. So Belchertown State School is probably, I'd say, the third most infamous state institution in Massachusetts, Danvers being the first. The Wall Street Journal State
I know
School
about Danvers.
Is second. Yeah, yep. So Danvers has the worst reputation. The Walter E. Fernald State School comes in second with all of its human experiments, and then Belchertown's a close third. And when I started reading about Belchertown, the only information really available and the only books available were about the time in Belchertown's history when it was at its absolute worst. So Belchertown is best known as being the state school that caused the closure of many state institutions with a massive lawsuit in the 1970s. And when I say massive lawsuit, I'm talking 44 pages worth of complaints about how bad it was.
I read about that. It was 1972. Unsafe conditions, raw sewage rising through a cafeteria drain, toilets in the open, showers with no privacy. Really awful stuff.
Awful stuff. When you get to the point where even the superintendent of the school says he will not eat food that comes out of the kitchen, you know that
that's
a problem.
Oh, terrible. Oh, my God.
But what I discovered pretty quickly after reading all of those books about the worst time in Belchertown's history, I realized that it was only a span of about 20 years in which all of this happened. It was almost like it happened in a vacuum, because from 1915 until the late 1950s, Belchertown was a model institution, and their entire purpose was to teach other state schools how to care for people with disabilities. The first superintendent used to come and lecture. The high school that I teach at now, he used to come and lecture at that high school and teach teachers how to work with students with special needs, which is a far cry from when we talk about the 1950s when there were no seats on the toilets and people were walking off and dying in the snow. You know, it's a completely different world. Yeah. All it took was one person who, you know, one person as a superintendent and a couple of short-sighted people in the Department of Mental Retardation to just ruin it. And they really just, it crashed and burned.
Well, that could be early. Yeah, it could be just like that, right, because once it starts going, it's going. You know, then nobody starts to care, which is, what type of disabilities did you find that they, that they did then, and how is it, you know, what type now would they be doing for disabilities? Because, you know, that's always a subject matter that nobody really knows about. They don't talk about that too much.
Well, the range of disabilities that would have gotten you committed back then is actually really similar to the range of disabilities that we still recognize now. We call them different things. We have much more politically correct terms for those disabilities. But the way we measure what disability is completely different. So when you look at some of the children who were sent to state schools back in the 1920s and 30s, they would not be considered disabled now. They might be considered learning disabled, and they might get a little bit of support in school. But other than that, no, there was nothing wrong with them. Children with cerebral palsy, children with epilepsy, Down syndrome, muscular dystrophy, any child that couldn't care for themselves the way a
in the mainstream,
child,
in the mainstream,
child was. Exactly. Or if parents realized that a child was delayed in some way, which meant that they needed, they weren't hitting their developmental milestones, they would be recommended for state school. But originally, the whole point of a state school was to give children skills that they could then take home with them so that they could get a job and eventually live independently. That kind of stopped in the 1950s when it became a warehousing operation. So it's kind of like we started off great, then had this horrible dark period, and now we're back to where we're supposed to be with the majority of people with disabilities are in the mainstream. They're educated in public schools. They have jobs. They live independently. And they're contributing members of society. In many cases,
which is which is really good, which is really wonderful.
Absolutely.
You know, it really is. You know, and a lot of schools do have, you know, programs, which so they can, you know, share experiences with other kids, you know, and because some of the disabilities can be, I mean, just because you have a disability doesn't mean you have to be like in the old, you know, in those days, just put in a place where you're not going to learn anything or you're not going to, you know, advance. So, and it's, you know, my sister taught special ed for years and years and years, and, you know, in a lot of in the schools in Chicago, which it was pretty intense, but they did, you know, there was a lot of, you know, people don't realize exactly what type of child is in there, and it's not just, you know, what people might think. So I think that there's the guidelines are, you know, it depends probably on the state. Is that true probably of what happens?
Yes. We have federal special education laws, but then there are also state-level special education laws, and the states have the flexibility to interpret them as they see fit, and it does definitely have an impact on what programs look like. I mean, Massachusetts leads the way in special education. We have done since the 1920s, our programs are heads and tails above a lot of the programs in the country.
Find in the programs? Like, what kind of treatments were available in the beginning, and what's available now?
So in the beginning, the main focus was vocational work. Most of the state schools, the purpose was to make sure that children could go home and not be a burden to their families. The purpose was to keep families from needing welfare assistance of any sort, whether that be welfare as we know it today or any kind of public assistance. They didn't want families ending up in the almshouse or the poorhouse because they had children that they couldn't care for. And in many cases, that's what used to happen. So state schools were meant to give these children vocational skills to help them with things like life skills, dressing themselves, personal hygiene, things like that. And they did have classes. They learned to read and write to the best of their abilities. They had kindergarten classes. I mean, this in the early days, the state school was a very well-rounded special education program. Back then, there was no such thing yet as occupational or physical therapy the way we know it today, but they got the kids outside. They had them playing games, learning how to play on teams, learning how to take turns, mm-hmm. You know, spending time in the fresh air, going down on
learning
the farm, doing work
skills,
on the farm.
That sort of thing. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And a lot of the kids mm-hmm. were learning their math skills by doing everyday tasks like working on the farm or working in mm-hmm. one of the vocational shops that they had set up, which we still do today. We still have a great emphasis on vocational work. Obviously, we're not using children to do the job that an adult should be doing, but we do
right.
still emphasize vocational skills, and, you know, it's a great social skills activity for kids. So in many ways, a lot has changed, but in many ways, a lot has stayed the same. We kept the really good stuff and just tweaked it to make it make sense for, you know, our current understanding of people with disabilities.
Right. And I think, I mean, that's the other thing. I think people, you know, they really don't understand. You know, I volunteered.
Yeah.
I was in one of my books, Love Changes. There was a child with Down syndrome, and I wanted to understand more. You can read things, but I went to volunteered, and I went in the lunch program, and I stayed for several hours in the morning to see, you know, really. My question was, why is it that some parents just leave their children and don't want to take them home at all? You know, and I mm-hmm. wanted to understand why the character did that. So I thought the only way I could do that is to see what really happens. And unfortunately, there are a lot of parents that do that. They don't want any
mm-hmm.
part of it, which is really so sad. You know, they
yeah.
don't come to see their children. They, you know, and they just want nothing to do. And it's really, that is a very difficult thing. And
mm-hmm.
the teachers were very loving, and it was really good, you know, to be there because you can understand it more. It was really hard writing that book for me because it came over me kind of like, you know, because it was when you're actually there, you're seeing this, and you just don't understand why people do this. But I was trying
mm-hmm.
to. You know, and I think that a lot of people don't know anything about this. And, you know, and I think in the schools, I think it's really good to have challenged children. Like, I know I went to my grammar school I went to recently, and I was so surprised and so happy to see the diversity and challenged children there now with mixed in and doing activities with others and being in the school. You know, and with diversity, I thought it was wonderful. I was so proud of the school, and then I found out later it was a blue ribbon school because it was different years ago. It wasn't like that, and I'm
mm-hmm.
so happy to see it was such a nice school. They had a cafeteria now. They changed a lot of things for today, you know, and I think that's the schools need to work on that a lot because I think, you know, I can see that there are a lot of places, you know, are different. So, and I do know it is depending on the state. But what you're saying is really important because, you know, I see in the grocery stores there's a lot of challenged kids working now, and I think that's really good,
mm-hmm.
you know. And but you also
mm-hmm.
see people not having patience. You know, they have to wait a few minutes. They should, you know. But
yeah.
you see, you know, it's true, though. You could see that they're annoyed
yeah.
and thinking, like, really? You know, because I think it's really good that this has happened now. So things have changed in that way.
Absolutely.
You know, you're probably always learning something now.
Yeah.
I would assume that this is just never ending.
Yeah, but when I was a teenager in the 1970s, I did volunteer work at some state mental hospitals. And we had art therapy, there was music therapy.
Mm-hmm.
The kids would go on, I think one reason that I was able to work well with them was that they were almost my age, so I could really
right.
relate to them. And we went on field trips. I mean, this wasn't a place where people were warehoused. It wasn't anything like that.
Right.
And
yeah.
this is back
right.
in the 1970s, and I had, it was a really good experience for me.
I think it is a good experience for people, and I think, you know, the fact that you've done this all these years, you're a special ed teacher, and write books and do all of these things, you can, you know, put this all together in a good way. That's why the speaking engagements, you're not just writing a book, you've also done it.
Right.
You know, which is always good, you know, because I think it's
yeah.
great knowledge, helps other people learn things, you know.
Absolutely.
Are there things you think should be changed? How do you feel about that? Are there things that need changing or upgrading?
As far as folks with disabilities, no, we do an amazing job.
Great.
With caring
That's
for folks with disabilities and giving them opportunities. Mental health, on the other hand, has so far to go still. Our mental health system in the United States is probably, I can say from my experience, probably one of the worst. Even though we lead the world in, supposedly in healthcare, and yet we just can't get mental health care right no matter how hard we try.
What do you think could be changed? I mean, it really is difficult because, you just sometimes people really aren't aware that people have a lot of mental illness until there's a problem. So I think,
that's part of it. The awareness, the education, I mean, we're just getting to a point now in 2019 where, students feel comfortable going to their teachers and saying, I have anxiety and this is what I need in order to be productive during my day, or I suffer from depression and I need this kind of support. And even then, kids are still very afraid to talk about it. And,
there's always been a big stigma.
We cultivated a society that was afraid to talk about mental health. And in reality, when you consider mental health treatment over the years and how it's changed, when asylums first came about in Massachusetts, for specific example, we created our first asylum and our first public hospital all at the same time. We were still trying to understand physical medicine, and here we are trying to then understand mental health care. And at least physical medicine, you could see that somebody's bone was broken. You could see that they were ill, and there were ways to treat them. But how do you treat something that you, first of all, can't see? And second of all, I can line up four people in a row and say that they each have the same diagnosis of, say, bipolar 1. But in each one of those people, the diagnosis is going to look completely different, and it's going to affect them in completely different ways, and it's going to affect their functioning in completely different ways. So it's very difficult to take something that you can't see and that you have to treat very individually. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. You can't just say, all right, well, here's the drug for bipolar and it should work for everybody, because that's not going to happen and it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, that's what we have done for many years, is we have tried to make it a one size fits all kind of thing. But we're up against insurance companies. And when you have an insurance company making decisions for someone and saying, well, we will only cover this many days of inpatient or outpatient mental health care. We will only cover this medicine, but not this medicine, even though the other one's the one you need. It's very difficult to offer the range of treatment that's needed for people to be successful in mental health treatment. And it's frustrating, especially, I spent so many years working in residential treatment facilities and later in juvenile lockups, and to see the limitations we place on people with mental illness is just, it's unreal. And we are, society in general is a big part of the problem.
Well, do some of the problems go back to the 1980s when Ronald Reagan deinstitutionalized mental health care? Does a lot of it go back to that? Yeah.
Believe it or not, deinstitutionalization started in the 60s with JFK. He was the first one to create the concept of deinstitutionalization because his sister had been lobotomized. So in the 60s, there was a big push for community mental health treatment. So Kennedy said, okay, cool, let's do this. They put it all on paper. It looked like a great idea. We start closing the mental hospitals. We provide community treatment. We do these group homes, we staff them, and everybody's going to be happy. But the problem was there wasn't the funding to back it up, and there wasn't the preparation. So they started closing these mental hospitals. When you consider, Danvers State Hospital, at the peak of its census, had close to 3,000 people in it. But go down south to, say, Milledgeville, Georgia, where at the peak of its census, they had 11,000. You're closing these hospitals and you're pushing people out into community treatment that is not ready for them. There were houses in neighborhoods where the residents didn't want those community homes because they didn't know what was going to happen there. Houses burned down. People choked to death because they weren't being supervised. And in many cases, like Northampton State Hospital, in the first year that it was closed, the police logged so many complaints of patients trying to get back into the hospital because they were miserable out in the community. There wasn't enough support for them.
Well, that's so sad. I mean, it really is sad when you think about that, you know, having nowhere to go.
Yeah. So now we fast forward to 2019, and our top three mental health care centers in the United States are prisons, because the prison population has swelled with folks who are mentally ill, especially in states where they have a three strikes law, where the third time that you commit a crime, you're automatically in jail. But when you consider someone who's mentally ill, you know, someone who is off their medication, they go and they steal food because they're homeless, and they get nailed by a cop, and they push that cop because they're hallucinating actively, and they can't discern between reality and their hallucination.
Yeah.
If they do that three times, they're going to prison. So then
which is not a solution.
The state of Ohio spent millions of dollars restructuring its prison system just to be able to accommodate the massive number of mentally ill inmates. And when you think about that versus we closed all of these institutions because we had gone so wrong, but now we don't have enough mental health care, and we're now restructuring prisons instead. Get your mental health care in a cell instead of a room at a hospital.
Yeah, that's
right. And then there's no chance of them even being able to go out because it's just, and they
there's
get exposed to things that they shouldn't either. I mean, they're exposed to people that they shouldn't probably be exposed to. They pick up bad habits, you know, from them.
Yep.
And when they wouldn't have had that, it's, you know, I think a lot of these things, you know. So your reader, okay, when you go to places, what do they ask you? I mean, what are their questions that they want to know when they're after reading your books and how they feel about them? Because it is a different subject that a lot of people, because you know, what do they ask you when you're there? If you go on, you know, speaking engagements with your books, what kind of discussion do they want?
Well, it depends on the audience. When I first started out, when I published my first book in 2006, it was straight nonfiction. It was a collected history of all the state hospitals and state schools in New England. And by and large, my crowd was always people who had worked in the field, nurses, psychologists, psychiatrists, former patients, former staff members, people who already had a lot of knowledge about the field and just wanted the connection of the history. So for a very long time, it was the same crowd. Their questions were always the same. It was always about kind of the evolution of mental health care. The big question was always whether or not I thought asylums should still exist. Did we still need state institutions on any level? But then when I realized I was getting the same group of people over and over again, that's when I wrote my first novel. I wrote Hospital Hill a few years after I wrote the nonfiction book, and I found that it drew a completely different crowd. People were a lot more willing to come and talk about mental health when they were talking about it through the lens of a cozy mystery. Because Hospital Hill is 100% historically accurate, except for the mystery that I wove into it, the characters I created. But everything else is, you're learning about the history of Northampton State Hospital and mental health care while you're reading this little mystery. So people would come in and they would be much more comfortable asking questions about mental health care and sharing their stories too. I mean, a lot of my book events are, I would say most of it is audience driven. I talk for a little while, but most of it is questions and folks who have stories to share. My very first book signing a thousand years ago, I was talking about Belchertown State School, and this gentleman stood up and said, I was at Belchertown for most of my life, and he talked about some of the things. I mean, I wasn't even needed anymore. I could have sat down and everyone was riveted. And I got a chance to actually talk to the gentleman. His name was Donald Zitkus. And he told me some of the stories, and he was also in the process of writing his memoir of life at Belchertown State School with another author, Ed Orzechowski, who is a really good friend of mine. Their book came out. It's called You'll Like It Here, and it's Donald's story about his time at Belchertown State School. And it's things like that that drive the talks that I do, is when people show up and they talk about their experiences, whether it be at a state school or at a state hospital, working there, living there, seeking treatment, inpatient, outpatient. Sometimes people just, they want to talk and they want to connect and they want to talk in a safe space. And since I'm already kind of laying it all out there, it makes people much more comfortable and they're more willing to ask the hard questions and questions that for some people.
And they're sharing, sharing is hard,
yeah.
And they're sharing. So, what better way to learn about things is by people that have been there, done that. I was at a graduation, and then there were some kids that came up, and it was a school that was a little different than other schools. It was actually it was pretty much mainstream, but there were also some kids that didn't really like to do homework, and they didn't like this and that. And so at the graduation, one of the kids, and it'll probably remain in my head forever, because it was a young girl. She got up, and the principal called her up to talk because she wanted to, and she shared her story. And it was like almost, you can't forget when people that are young, that are 18, and they're saying, was very anxious, I didn't want to do my homework. Mm-hmm. And those are problems that people don't understand, that there are kids out there that there's nothing wrong with them. They just don't, they're anxious. Mm-hmm. And she said she was anxious because her father had been in jail. And then when she said that, the room was, and she was, her life had changed. And then her mother had a young baby. And then she ended up getting pregnant. And she she doesn't have the baby yet, but it was so, watching her and hearing her with such honesty, how could you forget a story like that? And she was so thankful for the teachers for helping her graduate a high school. And it was like so unbelievable listening to that, because here's an 18-year-old talking about how anxious she is and how, what anxiety has done to her. And I think people just don't look at those things and see when kids have marital, the parents are divorced or they're not. In this case, her father was in jail. These kids were raised regular, just the same as everybody else, but they had issues in their life that made them become this way. And everybody says, I'm stressed out, but really there are people that honestly have big stress issues which causes all this. So
absolutely.
And it's nice to know that there's a school that was helping them get through it, because some schools, some of the counselors, they're not that great because they're always afraid that they're going to get sued now. That's a big problem.
Right.
If you go too far, then somebody's parent can sue them.
Yeah, and it's difficult. Have people
talked about what kind of – go ahead.
Oh, no, it's okay. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I just wanted to know if the people you talk to, have they told you what kinds of treatments work and what kinds of treatments don't? I mean, is there like a common theme to what they talk about?
No, not really. I mean, the common theme now, obviously, is medication. Most of the folks that, come to my talks now, obviously, are experiencing modern-day mental health care. So it's mostly about medication. Every once in a while, you'll get someone from an older generation who will say, I had shock therapy, very few people that are alive now are old enough to remember things like hydrotherapy and cold packs and lobotomy. I mean, we're so far removed from that generation of treatment that now most people either mention electroshock therapy or medication. Obviously, our first line of defense for mental health care is medication, and electroshock therapy is making a huge comeback, if you want to call it that. But it is considered kind of a last resort for folks who aren't responding to other treatments and who have severe clinical depression.
Yeah. What a society we have that there's so many people and that have this, you know, and I think that that is something, you know, you hear a lot of people on TV, they're talking about it a lot, and they need to address that because that would solve a lot of other issues that we have if they would.
Well, I don't know that the numbers so much have changed is that our ability to recognize and diagnose has changed.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
When you look at a lot of mental health care now, the shift, The numbers of adults diagnosed with mental illness is probably relatively the same as it would have been if we had the same diagnostic skills back in the 1800s. It's the number of children diagnosed with mental health issues that has risen. But, you know, to Marcia's point, we're living in a society where, you know, as a teacher, I walk into a classroom and I know that at least three of my kids are worried about whether or not the electricity is going to be on when they get home,
whether or not
they're going to have heat or hot water, whether or not there were enough benefits this month for mom to actually be able to get food, whether or not there'll be somebody home when they get home to let them in. We have a different environment that kids are growing up in.
It's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You have to have the basic needs met before you can go any higher than that. And worrying about the electric bill if the heat's going to be turned off is something pretty basic.
For young kids to be the ones who are responsible for worrying about that, and you're carrying that school with you, so that's your priority. Your priority is survival, you know, whether or not, you know, and for some of the kids in some of the neighborhoods that I've worked in over the years, you know, they're wondering whether or not they're going to make it home from school in one piece. You know, they're hiding weapons out in the bushes because they know they need to protect themselves on the way home from school. You know,
I live in Chicago, so, you know, this is a huge issue here. And my sister did teach in one of the worst areas here, you know, and, you know, but they were great with the teachers because, you know, the guards would walk them to the door and everything like that. But, you know, and it's progressed so much, you know, I mean, they talk about shootings. I think we've had 50 here on the, you know, it's on the south side, but it still affects the way people view Chicago, you know, and
it
really is, you know, and what you're saying is true. I mean, walking home, just a simple thing of, like, kids joking around. They can't joke around and walk. They're just looking around to see if they're going to be shot. And it's really traumatic for them. And so you're right about that, that when they go to school, it's like they're worried about walking home or, you know.
Right.
Will something be happening?
That sort of thing.
That needs to be changed for kids because, you know, kids are the future. And, you know, we have to
and
worry about that.
That's where education plays the biggest role is that we are their safe space. We are the place where kids can come and say, I'm dealing with this right now. I'm feeling anxious. I'm dealing with depression. And we are their safe space. And originally that's what institutions were supposed to be. They were supposed to be those safe spaces. And now we've just, you know, we're working on making it a community effort, and we're working on making it something that people are comfortable talking about. And it's, excuse me, you know, we still have a ways to go, but you can see the effects of the past mental health treatment and disability treatment. You can see how it's affected how we handle situations now. I mean, it's very, very clear how education has evolved.
Well, the medications are a godsend. Yeah, I was going to say the medications are a godsend. I have bipolar too, and I wasn't able to respond to any medication until the SSRIs came along. So Abilify and Latuda work on me, whereas nothing before. So I was just going up and down and up and down. And when I finally found the right medication, I function like anybody else. But I mean, I know there are people that are against the medications because they say they're poisonous. But I'm like, no, we really need this.
Well, if people need medications, that's another thing. People should understand that, you know, when people need medicine, they need it, you know, and it's, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I don't want to take medicine. But if it gets you to a place where you can have a good life, why not? I mean, this is bad that people just put such a stigma on things.
You're not going to sit there with strep throat and not take penicillin. Mm-hmm. You're not going to, you know, have cancer and not get chemotherapy. So why would you say, well, you have a mental illness, you shouldn't take medicine because it's poison? Well, technically, when you think about it, a lot of the stuff that we put into our bodies for other ailments is poison. But it's poison that works the way it's supposed to. I mean,
well,
yeah.
Right, because, you know, then you can function. I mean, you know, I mean, there's no, what's the sense,
exactly,
then, of having a horrible life when you can have a good life? I mean, it doesn't make any sense when people are like, oh, I don't want to take medicine. I worked for doctors for 20 years.
Well,
you know, people, you have to give, like you said, penicillin. You need to have things. You need to have, well, as with the immunizations, you need to have these things. You know, I mean,
right,
this is the way it works. You know, you
but
want healthy people.
On the other side of that conversation, though, is, you know, Elizabeth is one of the lucky people that has found a medication that works and hopefully has very few side effects. But you get some individuals who try these medications and may try every medication under the sun, and the side effects are horrific for some people. It all depends on your chemical makeup in your body and what the mental illness is doing to you. Because every mental illness in every person is going to be different. It's creating,
and that's why you need to have hospitals, right? And the hospitals are open. You know, a lot of the TV shows now are covering issues that it's not just playing around here. They cover issues by, you know, saying that, you know, people that are addicts, they can come in and they can get treatments. You know, so the shows are trying to portray that we need to do this for people, you know, and it's not just all fiction when you're watching the shows, because this is reality mixed in with it, you know, which is why your book, what you're saying, you mixed reality and your historic together, and that was a good match for you.
Right.
And, you know, that's what people, but it's also, you know, if you talk about it a lot and you think about all these things, yes, they have to show these things, because if one or two people are watching and say, oh, well, maybe I should go get treatment, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good thing.
Right, right. It's still better odds than, you know, if you're not talking about it at all.
Right, exactly. And some people are afraid to, you know.
Right.
And when they, you know, and they don't want to, because it does, you know, it has, some people, it has a bad effect on their personal and private life. If they actually say what's wrong with them, they don't want to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't always a good thing either. You know, but if they announce, at least if they face it themselves and get help, that's a good thing.
Exactly.
You know, and so that's what you do. So that's very interesting.
I hope that's what I do.
You're not just coming out. I mean, you have degrees. I mean, you also a special ed teacher. You know, I mean, it's not like you're just making it up here. You've already had training. You know, and so that's always best. You know, it's always best to have that when you are, you know, talking about an issue. And it's a big one.
Right.
A huge issue.
Exactly.
I mean, everybody knows about it. And probably somebody has it in their family. It's not something that just five families have. It could be 50 families. And you don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know. But when there's help out there, it's a good thing. And that's probably why they're asking you questions when they come and see you and talk about it. Because, you know, it's good. I mean, I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, that people are coming out and asking those kind of questions and talking and maybe helping somebody that's in the audience that's afraid to say something.
Yeah, and I think what makes it even better, especially here in Massachusetts, is over the years, because I've done this for so long and established myself in so many ways, I've had the opportunity to meet and work with a lot of individuals with the Department of Mental Health who are just,
that's great,
they're so happy that I'm doing what I'm doing, and that I get invited regularly to the Danvers State Hospital Cemetery Memorial Service, and people seeing everyone interacting with the Department of Mental Health people also helps break down that wall, because a lot of folks are afraid of the bureaucracy. They don't really know that faceless person who's on the other end of their benefits, and for them to see the Department of Mental Health caring so deeply about the history and about the future of mental health care, that also helps to break down some of the stigma and help normalize the conversation in so many ways.
Most important is that there's the conversation, which is a good thing, you know, and which means that it's getting out there. You know, and that's important, because, you know, if you don't talk about it, that's not going to help anybody, you know, that needs it. You know, and I think, Elizabeth, didn't you have a question about the cemetery? I know you were interested in that. I know you said that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to know a couple of things. I wanted to know, what are some of the most fascinating cemeteries you visited, and some of the symbols on the gravestones, they have specific meanings, and I wanted to know a little bit about those meanings on the gravestones.
So for me, I've always loved cemeteries from an architectural point of view. I love going through cemeteries and just seeing the craftsmanship in some of the monuments. My favorite is actually right here in Springfield, the Pine Street Cemetery, which is it's not its actual name. It's the Springfield Cemetery, but everybody calls it the Pine Street Cemetery. And there is one grave that I have loved since I was a kid. I was also a very creepy child. This didn't just happen overnight.
Oh, my God. I can't say that I've done this or want to do this.
My favorite gravestone is that of a very prominent real estate broker in the city of Springfield. His gravestone is a big granite mansion, and all his children are little tiny houses around him, and the above the door, the inscription says, in mansions above. That's always been my absolute favorite gravestone. I loved it. But most of my experience since has been with state hospital cemeteries, which is, it's a whole different world. It's so, you look at these beautiful cemeteries. Again, the fact that particular monument was so personal that I could look up this guy's name, find out, oh, he was a real estate agent. He had this many kids. He was married to this long. He lived on this street in Springfield. But you walk into a state hospital cemetery, and the only thing you could find is a tiny little numbered marker, and you have no idea who that person is. You don't know their name, when they were born, when they died, who their family was, where they lived, what they enjoyed. It's a whole different world. In some cases, there was one, Northampton State Hospital is an example. Their particular cemetery, it's essentially a potter's field, so it's everyone whose family didn't claim them when they passed were buried there on the state hospital grounds. And over time, the markers sank into the grass. And for many, many years, the cemetery was completely unidentifiable. The same thing happened with Danvers. The Danvers Cemetery was completely obliterated because no one was taking care of it until someone walking their dog. Pat Deegan was walking her dog in the 90s. She's a huge mental health advocate. And she stumbled on a couple of the gravestones, literally stumbled on them, and called the Department of Mental Health and said, why are you not doing something about this cemetery? What is going on here? So most of these cemeteries, these people have been buried there for
They have a lot of those in Chicago. There's one particular that the gravestones are, and somebody did get killed because the gravestone fell over on a young child because they really were not, they don't take care of it,
and those stones eventually
could have a problem, over hundreds of years or whatever. I should introduce you to Fran Lewis, who's also a blog talk host, and she does books about voices from the grave. She talks for the people that have died and tells stories about that because,
amazing.
She would like listening to you, and you would enjoy her.
One of my absolute favorite books is Lauren Rhodes' book, 199 Cemeteries to See Before You Die. If I ever get the chance to do a bucket list trip, as much as my husband will probably go crazy if I try to do it, I want to fit some of those cemeteries into my list.
It's not your everyday vacation, vacation.
But that's what you're
interested in, but it is, when you go to a cemetery. You look at the gravestones, you can't help but do that, and you do wonder, and a lot of times people, that are in, let's say, nursing homes, I know a lot of times people in nursing homes, the nurses come to funerals because they like to hear about the person the way they were before they had, like, Alzheimer's or something, and because they know that the person had a different life, they didn't come, to life
Absolutely.
This way. So I think those are all different things that people think. So, and you are incorporating all of this in your lifestyle, luckily your husband will go along with you on that.
Oh, he will. He will. He's great. He's a huge supporter of everything I do, no matter
That's
how
great.
Creepy it gets. As long as I'm not bringing dead things into the house, he's happy.
Okay,
with it.
Yeah.
So, But he draws a firm line there. So as long as it's alive and breathing, it can come in the house. But you know,
are you superstitious?
So, I mean,
are you superstitious at all? Are you superstitious?
I'm not. I have so many things in my house. It's funny because when people come over and they see the collection of the things that I have from different state hospitals and institutions, and they always ask me, "Aren't you afraid that you're bringing something home with you?" And
yeah, see, I'm so superstitious.
Always,
That's why I'm asking you that. Right?
I always tell this one story. Before they were tearing down Worcester State Hospital, I brought home a porcelain doorknob from a patient room, and I put it on the door in my apartment because I'm fairly handy. I was able to switch out the doorknob. And I didn't think anything of it until I got a cat, and he fell in love with that doorknob. He would sit there and he would talk to it. And he'd look around like he was watching something, and then he'd stand up and he'd touch the doorknob.
Wow.
And he had a different voice for the doorknob than he did for anything else.
Oh my God!
That's a story.
I used to tell that story to creep people out.
That's why I'm asking, because I think the thought of it. I mean, you know, bringing it in the house,
Well, I think for me it feels more like bringing home a piece of that history and a piece of that memory, as if I'm bringing home something that, you know, otherwise when you think about these houses getting torn down, they bury everything. So it's almost like those people getting buried once again. These are the things they used when they were at the hospital. These are the things they touched every day that, you know, perhaps was the only item that they were attached to, you know, if it was something like, you know, I found things like toothbrushes and, you know, bottles of shampoo and things like that. You know that those were personal possessions at one time, and to know that, you know, when these things get turned under or they get thrown in the dump, it is kind of yet another act of those things getting discarded, that person getting discarded. So sometimes it's nice to be able to look around and say, well, you know, I saved this thing that someone touched and someone used, and you hope that, you know, you maybe saved a memory somewhere along the way.
I guess that's a good way to look at it. Certainly someone like me, right? I'm writing that down, save a memory, because I like that thought. You just can't help some things that we are who we are. And a lot of times we are the same way we were when we were children, whether we like to believe that or not. And it appears that you were. you started out that way.
Well, at least one of the buildings at Danvers State Mental Hospital has been turned into apartments. So there's, you know, you see the facade, and then you're reminded of, you know, what this place used to be and how the people had been treated. So, I mean, it's been torn down, but the memory is not completely lost.
Absolutely.
Right. Some of your reviews were relating to that. They're happy that there's a memory there. It is the way, you know, we all have different feelings, but it's so interesting to talk to you. I mean, we were thrilled that you came on the show. I hope you come on again. And then we should get more into these other things, because this is these are interesting things, because these are things that, you know, people like to hear, because there's a lot of people out there that feel that way, you know, and sometimes it's interesting to, you know, how a conversation turns from one thing and goes to the next, certainly on my show, because as I said to Elizabeth, I said, well, we'll stick to a subject and we'll go everywhere else. But that's so much fun then, you know, because now we know all about you as a child, and that's how you were.
Well, I think the coolest part about all of it is that, you know, I started all of this as urban exploration. I started this as a checking out abandoned buildings, and then it morphed into reading and learning, and then it morphed into writing and sharing. And when I do book events, it's really cool to look out at the collection of people sitting in front of me and realize that there are some young urban explorers in the crowd. There are some older urban explorers. There are readers. There are writers. There are photographers. There are painters, artists, you know, former patients, former staff. Like I said, I mean, people from all over are sitting in the same room. And in many cases, you end up having these great conversations. I have a really good friend, Larry Smith, who created this incredible scale model of Danvers State Hospital that he's brought to a couple of my events. And just watching people, you know, crowd around this thing and talk to Larry not only about the creation of the model, but you're looking at a model of a building that no longer exists, and Larry has the details down to the graffiti that was spray painted on the pavement at the time, the things that were written on the doors. I mean,
your covers, actually your covers on your books are really good, especially the ones with all those nurses and nurses. I mean, they are. They're really good.
Yeah.
I put them out all over, and I'm looking at them because these are, you know, you just feel the story because you can feel it your covers.
That's another part of the whole thing, is because then you're bringing in the people who have maintained these historical archives. You know, these books wouldn't be possible without people who recognize the historical
significance
of these things, because people used to toss these things in the trash. But then you take a look at the Danvers book. The Danvers book wouldn't have happened without John Archer, who literally built part of his house out of the remnants of Danvers State Hospital. His house, he has a Danvers room. It's literally one of the towers. You know, and for people that become that invested, my second book, my Westboro book, that's coming out in July, wouldn't have happened without, there was a wonderful historical archive at the library. This gentleman, Anthony Baver, he was amazing. Just let me in his space. He literally let me take over his office and scan pictures for like 4 hours.
Wow.
And
it was nice. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Terrific.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Just the fact that there are people out there that recognize the historical importance of these things, it's the only way that these histories can survive. I mean, the Belchertown State School book that's going to come out next July, there's absolutely no way it would have happened, because the historical archive of Belchertown State School is so small because of its horrible history that everything that will be in the book only exists because one man, Don LeBrec, who worked for the Department of Developmental Services, was a history hoarder. And people like that are the only way these conversations can continue. Yes, I write the book, I put the pictures together, but I'm not the one who saved them, and I'm not the one who lived it. I wasn't there. These other people who were smart enough to say,
well, that's the only way we're
going to
know about history and things that happened.
Yeah.
Right. That's how it is.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, it's so this has really been very interesting. I thank you so much for coming on. And as always, Elizabeth always has the best guest that she decides. And I always say, yes, fine, that's good, I'll be happy. Because it's so interesting. This is something we've not talked about before. This is very interesting. And
I could talk about it for weeks. My favorite.
Well,
night.
Good. Then we'll have you on again. We will definitely have you on again. And
definitely,
you know, this is a live broadcast, but it's on demand forever. I mean, it's on YouTube, iTunes. I mean, and it's all over the place, and it's always out on the sites. And where can they find you? So if they were looking for you, on here. Your books are on Amazon. It's on our show page.
Yes.
But is there anywhere else you want to talk about where they can find you?
No. I mean, my books, like I said, my books are all on Amazon.
Okay.
I also have Facebook pages for the books. So Danvers, Belchertown, and Westboro all have their own pages. So anybody who wants more information about specific individual locations can find the Facebook pages that go with those locations.
I'm sure there will be people that want it, because this is a very interesting discussion. Elizabeth, where can they find you?
Let me find me on Facebook. I'm Elizabeth Black, and I'm on Blogspot at elizabethablack.blogspot.com. And one more quick thing.
I have to say about Ramsey next week. We have to say about our show next week.
Oh, okay, yes.
Go ahead, after that. Go ahead.
Okay.
No, go ahead. You say what you finished.
Oh, okay. Just wanted to say, if anybody wanted to see what Danvers State Mental Hospital looked like before it was torn down, stream the movie Session 9. It's an absolutely excellent horror movie, but you get they filmed it inside.
Yeah, that's, I took that from you today. Yeah,
down.
Session 9. Yeah,
yes.
That's a good
one. Session 9 is great. And
there's a 1950
film called Home Before Dark that is also very good. And you see the inside of Danvers in the 50s when it was still open and operating. So that's another good one.
And Snake Pit, was it called Snake Pit? That was, that's an old one.
Yeah,
too.
It was Olivia de Havilland.
Yeah. Okay, and you can, and next week Ramsey Campbell will be on at 8:30 in the morning.
No,
Central.
Not next week.
No, the week after. I'm sorry, the week after. Right. I'm not used to doing talking about that the week after. Okay.
No.
Right.
Okay.
Ramsey Campbell, he's a acclaimed horror thriller writer, author, and he's from the UK. And it's going to be a really good show. And that'll also be on demand if you have to work. You can't be doing this at 8:30 in the morning, so I guess, or 9:30 Eastern. And so it's always going to be out there. But he's very, he looks like he's going to be a very interesting guest. He's,
he will
has
be.
A lot.
He will be.
Yes. Yeah, I don't know. It's going to be. And Virginia and I and Crystal Gauthier, we're going to be doing a show also, and I'll be putting that out. It's next week, and it's going to be on movies to books and all about everybody thinking that their books should be movies, and maybe not, but maybe so. It'll be a very interesting show. And again, thank you so much, Catherine. It's been a really good show.
Yes, thank you for coming on to our show.
Yes,
it was a great show.
Thank you
really
for
good.
Having me. I appreciate it.
And have a good night, everybody. And you can reach me at michiganavenuemedia.com. There we go. All right. Good night, everybody.
Okay, good night.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.